Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I am really thrilled to have as my guest Jeff Dyer. His most recent book is a novel, or two novellas, or a set of travel writings, or projections, or meditations, or inquiries called Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi. He's the author, as well, of my favorite book about music, but really one of my favorite books called But Beautiful, a book about not writing a book of criticism about D.H. Lawrence called Out of Sheer Rage, a remarkable work on photography called The Color of Memory.
No, called The Ongoing Moment.
Oh, that's right, The Ongoing Moment.
Do you want to do that again?
Yeah. Oh, well, sure. But I'm not ashamed to be wrong. Let's just go on. The wonderful book of essays, Yoga for People Who Can't Be Bothered to Do It, a collection published in England of critical pieces called Anglo-English Attitudes. And here we are with Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi. Now, the reason I kind of love Jeff Dyer is that he has presented himself in essay after essay and fictional piece and blent the two and fictionalized himself here and elsewhere, but always as someone that you could like. Someone who likes to wake up late, to go out and find the best breakfast that can be found in whatever vicinity he's wandering, who likes to talk to people. And my favorite thing is that he's a critic who doesn't sound like a scold and a know-it-all. You know, there's a human voice that makes it sound as if the requirement for being a writer and a critic is to be in love with what you do and what you see, and to describe that love in terms that don't alienate others from feeling it or feel that a human could never aspire to these heights. There's a kind of lovely slouchiness. And I wondered, where does that voice come from? It wasn't there in the first book about John Berger, but it develops very quickly.
You're absolutely right. It's not there in the Berger book. And one of the strange things for me about that early book is that as soon as I'd finished it, I realized, why did I do that? What was the point of that? Here is this writer, John Berger, who'd made all of these freedoms available. Freedoms without which I couldn't have become a writer, I think. And then what do? I subject his work to this really timid, sub-academic kind of processing. And it seemed to me that, in a way, far from honoring him by doing that, I'd almost insulted him anyway. But it fulfilled a very useful function for me, that book. It got that kind of stuff out of my system. If there was some kind of feeling that that book was a kind of informal PhD submission. Well, after that, I was able to wave goodbye to any kind of aspirations like that. And I'm very glad I did now, because it seems to me that in many ways, the academy is a kind of ghetto, really. So I've been much happier being this kind of freelance, outlaw, gatecrasher, you know.
He has been as big an influence on me as on you. And I noticed that recently, in his recent work, he moves from the edges in. Mm-hmm. He doesn't like mm-hmm. centers. And even if he's describing a city square, he'll describe what's at the peripheries first. Mm-hmm. And that's a beautiful way of entering Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, because it seems to be a book that has, in its mind, the idea of throwing away the idea of the center.
Ah, yeah, that's very interesting. I think, yeah, if I'm getting you right, at the centre of many people's idea of what a novel's meant to do, it's meant to have a story and a plot. And perhaps because I've been unable to think of stories and plots, I've become rather sort of rather indifferent to those things. So, yeah, it does away with that thing which for many people is absolutely central to it. And at one stage, we can talk about this later, it had a bit more center to it, perhaps. And then at a certain point, I got rid of the center. The question then remains, what are you going to do? What else is going to do the work of what you've discarded?
Well, I think one of the discoveries in the book and in your work in general is that maybe modern life doesn't have a center. That it used to be that we were at the center of our story, but now we're one of the observers, or an observer of the observers, and you know we're busily looking on at an event that doesn't have a center, that's so, you know, like staggered and various. And then midway in this book, the book suddenly, and it's better not to be informed, so I won't say too much, but all the reviewers have said it, the book starts again with what may or may not be the narrator of the hero of the first part, mm-hmm. now being looked at, and now he's in India, and he's allowing himself once again to drift around, be led, fall from place to place. And what's kind of wonderful is that you found that Varanasi and Venice have been paired before. They have been called the same place by people as different as Allen Ginsberg and Henry James.
Yeah, that's right. And both of these places, in their very different ways, they've both been pilgrimage sites, really. Varanasi for Hindus, and you know Venice from way back before Henry James, actually, for the grand tour. For sort of art tourists, I guess, and that's another way in which they're twinned. And the characters in both parts don't do anything really that everybody else isn't doing.
And our hero is wandering around the Venice Biennale with the other artists, art critics, party goers, collectors, bankers, world fashionistas, as they drift from preferable party to preferable party in part one. Now, I'm curious, because you don't seem scheming in most conventional ways, and yet you seem to give evidence of knowing how to know what's going on party-wise in a given place. How do you do it? How does one do it? What are your tips?
Oh, well, I don't know if you saw that film that came out recently, a documentary about Mike Tyson. And, of course, one of the things that people always say about Tyson is that he was eaten away at, gnawed away at by all the hangers-on. So, of course, we go away from that film thinking, oh, yeah, these hangers-on are terrible. The truth is, though, that when you are a hanger-on, it's great. So I went, first of all, to the Venice Biennale 2003 because my wife was working for an art magazine. So I was the classic hanger-on, really, in that I had all the access with none of the responsibilities, and it was a fantastically good time for me. I think if you're in the art world, especially if you're an artist, it can be a rather anxious, perhaps even galling time, because especially if your work is not being presented there. Whereas for me, I'm interested in art, of course, but I don't have any kind of stake in it. And we'd been there about three of the 4 days when it seemed the obvious thing to do, because 2003, I should have said, there was this incredible heat wave which created a kind of mania or fever. And that's when I had the idea of doing a version of Thomas Mann's Death in Venice set during the Biennale.
Now, a version in what sense?
Oh, well, in the Thomas Mann, you've got this world-famous composer, goes to Venice and becomes obsessed with this with this book, you know, with this beautiful boy, Tadzio. And of course, it's never made, what it's certainly not is a straightforward pedophilic kind of crush. It might have elements of that, but there's all sorts of other things as well. Is the boy an incarnation of ideal beauty? This kind of thing. And I liked the idea of doing a version of that, which would be, you know, the central character meets someone. In this case, it's a young woman from a gallery in California. And for some reason, she won't give him her phone number. She says, if we bump into each other again, that'll be great. So there's the sort of premise, the conceit that we're going to, that's the echo of Death in Venice. But everything that was going to happen in my book was going to be much lower down the cultural totem pole. So instead of being a world-famous composer, he's going to be a really fed-up hack journalist. And the relationship that he's going to develop with Laura, the American woman, is going to be very carnal and hedonistic. But there will be that slight, for the first stages of the book, I wouldn't go so far as to say that it's a form of suspense, but you know, you're wondering, is he gonna bump into her again?
It's almost as if his state of anxiety or fear is such that she might cross the patio and he thinks that she might not come back to him.
Well,
he's perpetually surprised to find her again at his side. And that feeling of people who've lost trust in being able to read the signs
mm-hmm.
is very, you know, especially in an art world that's, you know, broadcasting all sorts of non-interpretability in the works of art. This relationship has the confusion and twittering sound of something that might look sincere but might be ironic, and he's used to irony but not to sincerity.
I pick up on that, though, in part two, where there's a line which is really crucial to the book when the narrator makes a friend in Varanasi, and with this friend he says that I liked this guy because he realizes that it's possible to be 100% sincere and 100% ironic at the same time. So all of that kind of repartee that's going on between Laura and Jeff, I mean, it's all very trivial, but at the same time, it's really, everything is quite charged. I mean, so it's incredibly flirtatious at the beginning. And we realize that actually by the end, he is actually longing to say, you know, oh, can't we, you know, isn't this the beginning of a relationship? Whereas you get the sense that she's happy just to regard this as a discrete moment, a discrete interlude, really, without any follow-up. And of course, so that leaves him potentially at the end every bit as distressed as he was when we encounter him at the beginning of part one.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Jeff Dyer, author most recently of Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, published by Pantheon. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Jeff Dyer about his novel, Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi. And in part two, we are in India once again. We've got a character on assignment. We're not sure it's the same character. Did you know when you wrote it, did this distinction or this dispersion, because in a certain way, not knowing if it's the same character is, for the reader, a version of the character's experience in India
as
his own self dissipates.
Yeah, and as you say, we're in India. It's this. We're in the holiest Hindu city, and in some ways, let's say the narrator in part two is a reincarnation of the person in part one.
Or brilliant.
One of the confusing things when you're reading about the Hindu myths is that the deities are all avatars of each other. it's difficult to say who's who. And at one point in part two, I say, it's really difficult to make sense of this. I mean, is the same person that we've been hearing about on page three the same person that we're reading about now on page six? Which is, I like these books which have diagrams of what's going on in the book. So in a sense, you could say that the person in part two is an avatar of the person in part one. But I think just to put that in context, I should explain something. When I first wrote the book, there was no doubt at all that part two followed on chronologically from part one, and it was definitely the same person, although we swapped from the third person to the first. And in Varanasi, he explained something of what became of the romance in Venice. And then a friend who had been my editor said that I needed to make that narrative stronger, to make what happened in part two more obviously implicit in part one. So I tried to do that because, you know, I'm very diligent, you know, and I could see he had a point. And I couldn't make any progress. And one of the things I've learned in all these years of writing is that the very worst thing you can do is struggle on when you're not making any progress, like riding a bike with the brakes on. Then I had this great breakthrough, and I realized I'm not going to try to solve this problem. I'm going to do away with the problem. I'm not going to try to paper over the cracks. I'm going to emphasize the split. And so what happened is that now it's absolutely not clear if it's the same person. It's not even certain that it comes chronologically after. And instead of this thick, sturdy narrative rope, now we've got maybe just 50 little chimes or echoes. We've got these fine, almost invisible filaments. So there are just these tiny little insignificant details which crop up in part one, and then they're echoed again in part two. And in that way, I hope that's what means that this is very definitely not two sort of half books that I just stuck together. It's in that way that I think it gives a completely unified aesthetic experience, but I hope a kind of new and as yet previously unseen a kind of aesthetic unity.
It's quite exciting and quite lovely. Now, the second novel, you've mentioned that it's someone going crazy, but for this reader, it was someone having a spiritual experience. Do you want to weigh it either way?
No, I went to some pains to keep it that ambiguity neat, really. And of course, you know, we've heard all these cliches. You know, was it a breakdown or was it a breakthrough? All of this kind of stuff, and I mean, it's just to fill people in a bit. So the guy's name in the first part is Jeff with a J, Atman. And, of course, Atman is this Hindu word for, I don't know, true self or soul, something like that. So you could say that in a way he makes the progression from being Jeff self in the sense of Martin Amis's John self in Money, completely self-centered hedonistic in part one, to finding his, you know, deeper self, or actually, I mean, quite literally what happens is that he loses his passport, so he loses his identity, really. And, you know, it's not for me to say whether he ends up in this state of blissful enlightenment or whatever, but yeah, certainly I was aware of the need to keep that ambiguous. And of course there's a lovely long tradition of this kind of thing. I always come back to that lovely line of Blake's, you know, when he says, wisdom is found in the desolate market where few care to buy.
The loss of self, in a way, is figured in all kinds of ways in the second half of the book, but one of them is a very beautiful passage where he's robbed of the coolness of his identity by a monkey stealing his sunglasses.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought I'd ask you to read it.
Oh, with great pleasure. He'd snatched the sunglasses on impulse because they were shiny and because they were there. But he'd not stolen them, we realized now. He'd taken them hostage. Worthless in themselves, they nevertheless had considerable exchange value. I made a gesture I'd seen in statues of the Buddha, hand raised, dispelling fear. Wait, I said. Just wait. The monkey made no acknowledgement. I walked backwards to the covered part of the terrace, where there was a tray of fruit, a bunch of three bananas. I stuffed a couple in my back pocket and came out holding the third. I held it in one hand at arm's length, ready to drop it if he rushed me, with the other closer to my chest, still raised in the mudra, dispelling fear. The monkey was holding my sunglasses. Moving slowly, not taking my eyes off him, I put the banana on the wall separating us. When I'd done this, I made sure that both my hands were visible, raised, palms facing him. He just sat there, poker-faced or oblivious, it was impossible to say. I reached into my back pocket, took out a second banana, and put it down beside the first. I retreated again, palms raised. The monkey looked away, swatted at a fly with my glasses. He shook his head, a gesture that might have had no connection at all with my new, improved offer. "You really want to play hardball, don't you?" I said. "Okay, I'm through messing around." I took out the last banana and put it next to the other two, forming a bunch. Keeping my eyes on him, I turned slightly so that he could see that I had no more bananas in my pocket. "That's my last offer," I said. "Take it or leave it." My hands were still raised, but now I crossed them over each other in what I hoped was a universal, trans-species gesture of finality and closure. I took a step back. If the offer was not accepted, if negotiations broke down, I'd no intention of snatching the bananas back. It was a matter of honour now. The ball was in his court. I wanted my sunglasses back. Of course I wanted my sunglasses back, but I was conscious also of the historic importance of this encounter. In terms of the development of his species, the step the monkey was about to take, the step I hoped he would take, was on a par with Neil Armstrong's giant leap from the lunar module to the dusty surface of the moon. "It's down to you," I said. "You've got a straight choice. You can leave the sunglasses and take the bananas. In other words, you can start evolving. Or you can grab the bananas and make off with the glasses as well, but if you do that, you'll just be a chimp for the rest of your days. And one other thing, too. If you do that, I swear I'll hunt you down, like a dog. So make your play." In the course of this speech, my hands had gradually lowered. They hung at my hips now, like a gunslinger's or an ape's. The monkey twitched slightly.
Jeff Dyer, reading from the second half of Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi. I love that sense of transaction, especially since it leads him to the threat of devolving. "I'll hunt you down like a dog." And it seemed to me to stress another kind of distinctiveness in this novel. For some reason, I think inappropriate, but you've been compared to the Austrian novelist Thomas Bernhard. I find this work much more generous than the famous Grouch Bernhard, who liked to be an enemy of the people, an enemy of the government, an enemy of his friends, and that this work has, even in its, pardon me, dire moments in its second half, a great willingness to surrender to the world.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens in part two, I think. To go back to Bernhard, though, I went through this incredibly intense Bernhard phase just before and just during, I guess, when I was writing the Lawrence book. And what I took from Bernhard was that, you know, that incredible, insistent, lunatic repetition that he does. And what I'd say about Bernhard for me, I don't know what happens here, but the UK editions come with this quote on the back from George Steiner saying, "Oh, yes, in the great kind of, you know, European tradition of Hermann Brock and so forth." For me, Bernhard is far and away the funniest writer. And I'm one of those people, when I read these so-called comic novels, I just sit there stony-faced because all they're trying to do is be funny. And I really like the way that things can actually, just as we were, similar to what we were talking about, sincerity and irony, I think things can be serious and hilarious at the same time. And actually, I like books with ideas in them. And, you know, what is a joke if not an idea expressed in with supreme concentration? It's a whole argument often compressed into just a few lines. So So I think there are Bernhardian traces here in the neurosis of the narrator, and in that way that sometimes you're reading a passage here and it's so sort of awful, and at the same time you're sort of sniggering to yourself. I hope, anyway. But what it's not doing is waving up a big flag saying, this is a funny scene, this is a comic novel. I don't like books which are only one thing.
But the biggest difference to me is I don't feel in your work misanthropy.
No, I don't think there is misanthropy there. And this could relate to something that's come up quite a bit. In a number of reviews, particularly in Britain, part one has been called a satire on the art world. And so this has led me to think a bit about satire. And one, it seems to me that, I mean, whenever I've read this, I didn't like hearing that I'd written satire. And it seems to me that one of the things about satire, it's a peculiarly greedy mode. It's really omnivorous. So it eats away at everything else until by the end you can only be satirical, I think. And I would hope that what we get in this book is there's all sorts of things of things being ridiculous. The most ridiculous person of all is always the protagonist or the narrator. But that ridiculousness is really compatible with a sense of grace or wonder and lyricism.
And fallibility.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. And then the final thing, which I put out to you, I haven't worked out if this is absolutely true, but I wonder if satire as a form is one of those things which is determined by intention. I know you can be unintentionally comic, but I don't know if you can write satire unintentionally. So I'm tempted to say the fact that I didn't think I was writing satire means I wasn't. I don't know if that's true, but that's the position I feel comfortable with.
I think Swift knew he was writing satire, and
indeed,
when he didn't know, he wasn't. I've been talking with Jeff Dyer, author most recently of Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi, published by Pantheon. Thank you, Jeff, for joining me.
Oh, thank you, Michael. Great pleasure.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Jeff in Venice, Death in Varanasi at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our new media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
You can go in books to the land of ice and snow in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones from our website. Go to kcrw.com/bookworm. Plus copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
There are your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's Book of the Mouse Club time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.